Good morning, everybody. We excitingly will begin studying the book of Nehemiah this morning as we continue with our learning of Shivat Zion, of the story of the return of the Jewish people from exile all the way back to Yerushalayim. Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you. Okay. So what we're going to do today is I want to do a few things. One is I want to learn with you a little bit. Up until now, we have not done an enormous amount of text-based study. So today, we're actually going to read a parak inside. And what I want to accomplish by doing that is to learn a little bit about Nehemiah. Now, obviously, as we're learning, one of the things that should be going through our mind the entire time is how do we compare and contrast our study of Nehemiah with our study of Ezra. Although they are, in all likelihood, one book, we have split them apart. They are two individual personalities, in all likelihood. And what I want to do is compare and contrast them and the roles that they play and their approaches to everything. Now, you already understand fully well everything there is to know about Ezra because of what we've learned about him up until this point. That's not so true, because we're going to re-meet Ezra in the later part of Sefer Nehemiah, and we're going to learn a lot more about him then, but a lot of the themes that we've developed are going to simply expand upon them from there. So you have the foundation already to go, and all we have to do is, again, build upon that. What we will see is that Nehemiah encounters, in many regards, a very similar situation to the one that Ezra encounters. Number one, he receives permission from a foreign king to return to the land of Israel and to build something. We'll see exactly what his focus is going to be. Number two is you have a new leader, right? In the book of Ezra, you had Zerubbabel, you had Yoshua, you had Ezra. Here we encounter a new leader, of course, Nehemiah. You are going to encounter opposition. You are going to encounter construction. And you are going to encounter Aliyah, and you are going to encounter mass ignorance. So basically all the fundamental components that we encountered in the book of Ezra, you're going to encounter once again in the book of Nehemiah. When you see two stories that are so comparable in many regards, obviously it's not only to highlight the similarities, but also to allow us the framework to contrast the two of them. And that's where the real money is going to be in the studying of the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a little bit different than Ezra in the sense that it's written in first person. And we'll have to develop why it's written in first person as we go along as well. So let's jump right in. You have one page, two sides of a page, and we're going to start right at the beginning of the book of Nehemiah. And again, as with always, you can choose to read in Hebrew with me, you could choose to read along in English with me, or you can choose to not look at the page at all, listen outside. Here, we're looking for two things. The text is important here, which is why I'm reading it inside. Also, the themes are important here. So as you're learning it, pay attention to any words that might sound familiar to you, perhaps from other parts of Tanakh. Pay attention to any themes that might sound familiar to you from other parts of Tanakh. And again, that's what we're looking for whenever we read a Sefer in Tanakh. So here we go. Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia, vayi bechodesh Kislev, shnat Asrim, v'ani ayisi b'Shushan Abira. So he's in the city of Shushan, which of course is in Persia. We know those two words, Shushan Abira, from where? Well, we know from Megillah, but that word Bira is used in another city in Tanakh also. What city? Yerushalayim, right? Yerushalayim is also Bira. So keep that all in mind. And what month are we in? This is going to be important. We're in the month of Kislev. Okay. Vayavo Hanani echad me'echai. So one of my brothers, Hanani, in all likelihood, the Mefarshim point out, he is not actually a brother, but he's like a, hey, brother, right? Okay, you meet a guy in the subway. So, hey, brother, right? Vayomer Hanani echad me'echai. Huva nashim Yehuda. And Hanani comes from Yehuda. Now, again, they didn't have text messaging. They didn't have WhatsApp or FaceTime. So information traveled by people, and it took a long time to get there. So Nehemiah, and we'll see, but he is in a political position in Persia. He does not know what's going on in Yerushalayim. And all of a sudden a messenger comes from Israel and is going to describe for Nehemiah the state of the Jewish people in Israel. And what happens? He wants to know. Nehemiah says, I asked about the Jews that in Yerushalayim. By Yomru Li, Hanisharim Asher Nisharu Min Ashvi, Sham Bamedina, Shevi, excuse me. No, Shvi here. Sham Bamedina. It says Shvi. I'm looking in my Tanakh. Okay, Shvi. Sham Bamedina. Bera'a Gidola Uvecherpa. What do those words mean? Ra'a Gidola. What we would call a precarious situation, a terrible situation. Right, ra'a gedolah, it's really horrible what's going on. Uve cherpa, cherpa means? It's a busha, it's a disgrace what's happening there. So, pause. Okay? In and of itself, that is a dramatic description. It means everything we learned in Ezra about the intermarriage, and right, it means that things are really bad. We may not even fully have appreciated just how bad things are. Now, there's a break between Ezra and Nehemiah, which means that in a short period of time in between when Ezra arrives on scene and when Nehemiah arrives on scene, it means things went from bad to worse. Okay, those are strong words. Ra'a gedola uvecherpa. It's a disaster what's happening. Shan, exactly. It's a shan uvecherpa. Okay, and v'chomat Yerushalayim meforatzet Usharetza Ushare Nitztu Baish. Now he points out two different things. Number one is he says the state of the Jewish people is a disaster. But he then pinpoints one particular area which bothers him. And that is what? The walls of Yerushalayim. He's upset that the walls of Yerushalayim are breached. Okay, now we know, because we live in an age where walls are important. Again, we pointed this out last week. Okay, walls are important. And because walls are, you think Trump's the first one to realize that? He's not. Nehemiah, Lahavdil, many years ago understood that walls are important. We have to see why exactly he's going to become so infatuated with walls, but that's going to be his construction project. Don't forget, the Beis HaMikdash is built. Right? That already was accomplished during the time of Ezra. So now, we're fixated on the walls. What's the symbolism of the walls? Why are the walls so important? Why does he highlight that? He could have just said, "Bira'a gedola v'cherpa." It's a disaster over there. He then pinpoints that the walls of Yerushalayim are breached as a particular point of disastrousness. Pasuk Dal, Pasuk 4. Vayhi kishami yesa devarim ha'ele. When I heard all about this. So what does he do? Yashavti, I sit on the ground. Ve'evche, I cried. Ves abla yamim, and I mourned for days. In other words, this was not just go on Facebook, lament to your friends, oh, it's so sad what's going on in Israel, and then go on to Menchie's to eat ice cream. This means you did it for a number of days. Ve'hi tzam, he fasted. Umitpalel lifnei Elohei Hashemayim, and he davens to Hashem. Is this extraordinary? Well, we don't know if it's extraordinary. We don't know anything about Nehemiah, right? Did we know anything about Ezra? A little bit. Ezra, had a description for us. What was the description of Ezra? He was a sofer. He was proficient in the Torah of Moshe. We were given an introduction to who Ezra was. Were we given any introduction to Nehemiah? No, we know nothing about Nehemiah. Okay? All of a sudden, we find that he's basically following a familiar formula. Right? What is that? Fasting, davening, crying, mourning, davening to Hashem. Right? This is similar to Ezra's playbook. So it's not entirely unfamiliar to us. The difference is going to be what he does next. And we're going to get to that in a few pesukim. But so far, so good. He is fasting, he's mourning. Okay, he's davening. Va'omar, he says, Ana Adonai Elohei HaShamayim, the God of Shamayim. Now, this is as opposed to Ezra, who referred to Hashem as Hashem Elokai. Here he is Elokei HaShamayim, Ha'el HaGadol VeHanora. We know that from, well, it's from Esrei, but originally Moshe. Okay, so those we're familiar with those words. Shomer HaBrit VeHaChesed Lo Avav UShomrei Mitzvosav. God, you who keeps the covenant and does chesed, does kindness to those who keep your covenant. Okay, so he's imploring God to do kindness. Shomer HaBrit, keep your end of the bargain. Tehina Pasuk Vav, Tehina Aznecha Kashevet, Ve'inecha Ptuchot Lishmoa El Tfilat Abdecha, Asher Anochi Mitpalel Lefanecha Yom, Yomam V'Layla B'nei Yisrael Abdecha. Okay, let's unpack that. Tina aznecha kashevet, your ears should be listening. Veinecha p'tuchot, and your eyes should be open. Lishmoa el tfilat avdecha, to listen to the prayer of your servants, that I'm davening here day and night. Umitvadeh, and I'm doing vidoy, which means I'm confessing, al chataot b'nei Yisrael, the sins of the Jewish people, asher chatanu lach, that we have sinned against you. Vani ubeis avi chatan. I in my father's house have sinned. Now that's interesting. Well, let's finish it, and then we'll come back. Chavol chavanu lach velo shamarnu es hamitzvos ves achukim ves hamishpatim asher sivis es Moshe abdecha. We have not done a very good job. We have fallen short of our responsibility. Zechor nasa davar asher sivis es Moshe abdecha leimor. Remember what you told Moshe Rabbeinu. Atem timalu v'ani afit etchem b'amim, that you're going to sin against me, and as a result, I'm going to punish you by spreading you all around the countries, the nations of the world. V'shaftem alayin, when I do that, Hashem says, you're going to return to me. Ushmartem mitzvosai, and you're going to, all of a sudden, there's going to be a mass teshuvah movement. V'asitem otam imi yenidachim ikse hashamayim isham akabetzcha. Right, if you are scattered, I'll gather you. I'm going to gather you together. Okay, we can pause for a second. What's interesting about Nehemiah's davening? So again, Nehemiah arrives with no fanfare, as opposed to Ezra, who we at least have a little bit of a description. Does Nehemiah arrive on the scene with any description? No. So there's this almost this tone of modesty. We don't know who Nehemiah is. He's like a random Joe Schmo at this point in time. All of a sudden, he hears bad news about Israel, and he goes into davening mode. So, if I asked you, what type of a Jew is Nehemiah, what would you tell me? Religious. And how do you know he's religious? Well, you know he's religious because he fasts, he davens, he mourns, he davens to Hashem, he's sitting on the floor, he's crying. What's interesting, though, is, do we see any real religious manifestation from Ezra up until this point of what we know about Ezra? Right, we know that he's bothered by certain things, but if you paid attention, and I think Sarah already jumped upon this, there's a lot of biblical references in Nehemiah's tefillah. So for example, if you look in Tehillim, 130, Kuf Lamed, Pasuk, Bet. We say it very frequently. What do we say? Adonai Shim'a Bikoli, Tiyena Oznecha, Kashuvot L'Kol Tachnunai. Okay? Who wrote? Okay, so already we have in Pasuk 6 a reference to Tehillim. You also have a reference to Sefer Malachim. Malachim, when Shlomo is building the Beis HaMikdash, or when he's dedicating the Beis HaMikdash, excuse me. So if you recall, Shlomo had issued a very significant tefillah, a very significant prayer to Hashem. And in the context of that prayer, sorry, I should have marked this in advance. And in the context of that, Shlomo HaMelech says the following. This is chapter 8, verse 29 of Shlomo, of Malachim. He says, Liyot einecha pituchot, Ela bayit hazeh laila vayom, ela makom asher amarta yesh misham. That one of his prayers to Hashem is that Hashem's eyes should always be open to this place, day and night. Lishmoa el atfila asher yitpalel avdecha el hamakom hazeh. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Right, to listen to the prayers that your servant is going to give on this day. And lastly, there's a reference to an episode in Sefer Vayikra. Now this is from Parshas Acharei Mos. Here, the Torah tells us the following. 16. Okay, give me a second. V'ikriv Aaron es parah chatas asher lo, that Aaron is going to bring the par, the cow, v'chiper bado v'ad beito, and it's going to be a forgiveness, an atonement for his house, for himself and his house. They slaughter the animal, and then what happens when he does vidoy on it? V'samach Aaron et shtei adav al rosh ha'seir, v'itvada alav, and he confesses. And what's the confession? V'et kol pish'eyem l'chochat asam, v'nasan osam al rosh ha'seir, right? V'chiper ba'do, as we say in the Machzor, uva'ad beto. Now that's interesting. In Pasuk 6 alone, you have three references to Tanakh. You have a very strong reference to Tehillim. You have a reference to the consecration of Shlomo Melech in the Beis HaMikdash. And you have a reference to the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur confessing on his part. What is the significance of that trifecta? Well, he's well-learned. That's going to be important for us. Yes, he is proficient in Torah, despite the fact that he is not identified as such. Ezra is identified as such. Nehemiah is not. But the proof is in the pudding. Now we'll see Chazal are going to lament what they're going to consider Nehemiah's arrogance. Now, you don't gain arrogance here, right? I don't read arrogance in his tefillah here. So there's clearly going to be some form of a transformation of Nehemiah. You sense modesty here, right? Someone who immediately hears bad news turns to God. There's modesty there. But what do you make of the three references to Tanakh in Pasuk 6? Tehillim, Shlomo's dedication to the Beis HaMikdash, and the Kohen Gadol. Well, to me, there's a very strong significance to those three. David HaMelech is, of course, the Davidic dynasty. Shlomo HaMelech is the continuation, the perpetuation of Malchus Beis David. And the Kohen Gadol is the Kohuna, is the Kohen. So what he's doing is he's referencing models of leadership, significant models of leadership. Don't forget, we had bifurcated those two forms of leadership in the beginning of Ezra. You had Zerubbabel and you had Yehoshua. Here he's referencing them all together. Why is he doing that? Why is this significant? So it could be for a number of reasons. Number one is because we know nothing about Nehemiah, what might Nehemiah want to be doing?
Create one nation.
Well, establishing his bona fides. Right? If you don't know me, and I get up, and I start quoting Churchill. Every speech I give is all about Churchill. So that identifies me. That gives a profile of who I am. It gives you an insight into who I am. Okay, the people I choose to reference, the stories I choose to tell, the politics I choose to espouse, right? All of that gives you a little bit of a glimpse into who I am. And if, let's say, you have doubts over whether I'm smart enough, so then I might choose to quote philosophy in my speeches. If you have a doubt about whether I know Torah, so I might choose to throw in psukim or a gemara into the way I speak to give people a little bit of an insight into the brand that I'm trying to create in your mind, right? Everyone has a brand. And so if I want you to have a certain impression of me, I'm going to use terminology, references, I'm going to name drop, right? These are things that we do to give audiences that might not know us a little bit of an insight into who I am. That perhaps is what Nehemiah is doing here. We don't know Nehemiah, but he quotes significant leaders and paradigms of leader because he's trying to help us understand a little bit of who he is. Shlomo, David, Kohen Gadol. He's essentially saying, I'm continuing in that model of Zerubbabel, Yehoshua, Ezra, which are Malchus Beis David, Kohen Gadol, and learning. Right? Those are the three people. Nehemiah is trying to give himself the street cred, as we say, street credibility, in all three of those arenas. Davidic dynasty, Kohen Gadol, and a learned individual. Okay, so that's perhaps suggestion number one. Suggestion number two, or maybe even like a corollary to that, is that the Tanakh, or Nehemiah, is trying to not just give himself street credibility, but is trying to create his image in the image of his forefathers. Right? When you want to be successful, let's say you're coming before a judge. So the greatest argument you can make to a judge, other than the street camera was broken that caught me running the red light, is to say, no, you don't remember me. I'm Johnny's grandson. Remember Johnny did you a favor a lot of years ago and you guys had such a warm relationship. So I'm Johnny's grandson. And oh, do you remember Bob? Bob's your best friend. Well, he was my neighbor. Right? You play a little... Right? We're the kings of that. It's called Jewish geography. Okay? So he's name dropping here. He's essentially coming before Hashem and he's saying, I'm continuing in the ways of David and Shlomo and the Kohen Gadol. Now, why is that important? Perhaps that's important because of the way the Tanakh introduced us to what's going on here. What's going on here? We have, what do we know about what's happening in Yerushalayim right now? It's a disaster. It's much worse than we ever could have anticipated. Now, we only know one of the reasons for why it could be worse. Intermarriage. We were exposed to that previously, but we're going to learn in Nehemiah it was a lot worse than that. It was economic injustice, mistreatment of those who are on the fringes of society. It was a disaster. And so perhaps things were a lot worse than we thought they were. And if things were a lot worse than they thought that we were, desperate times call for desperate measures. And so this wasn't just any tefillah to Hashem. He's pulling out all the stops. He's bringing out the big artillery and saying, God, I'm bringing out the big guns. I need you to remember the merit of those who came before me, those who approached you in similar situations. Now, who else does this in Tanakh? We have other people who do this in Tanakh. Right? Yosef finds himself in a precarious situation in Mitzrayim. He finds himself in a position of power in the king's palace. Okay? At Mordechai finds himself in a similar situation. Esther finds herself in a similar situation. So he's not the first. Daniel, for those who remember, find himself in a similar situation. So he's not the first one, and he has a history, he has a rich tradition of people who were in positions of power in very precarious situations, religiously, physically, spiritually. And again, that's all going to be important as we continue on in the parable. So chapter number one is really all about Nehemiah appearing on the scene, him realizing how dire the situation is in Israel, and his tefillah, his davening to Hashem. Now we come to chapter 2. We're only going to do the first half of chapter 2 today because it really fits more to chapter 1. We'll do the second half next week. Fine. Comes to chapter 2. Vayhi bechodesh Nisan, shnat esrim, l'artachshasta hamelech, yayin lefanav, ve'esas hayayin ve'na lemelech v'lo ayisi ra lefanav. Let's unpack this. We're in the Chodesh Nisan. When were we in the beginning of last week's chapter? Kislev. Kislev to Nisan is how many months? 5 months. So there's a 5 month break in between chapter 1 and chapter 2, which means that despite all of his angst that he felt over the situation in Israel, he sits on it for 5 months. Now, why does he sit on it for 5 months? Well, I could think of one or two reasons. Either he's nervous, he's anxious, right? You ever had to have a difficult conversation with someone and you put it off and you put it off and you put it off and you hope the issue goes away? Well, that could be what's going on here, right? He knows that he's got to do something about it. But he also knows that if he uses his position of power, if he uses it wrongly, then he's going to be out of power very quickly. Right? We know, think about it even as Jews in America. Think about the story in World War II of when do you yield power? How do you yield power? Is it wrong to yield power? Is yielding power a good thing? Is yielding power a bad thing? I had someone stop me the other day. We had this amazing Teach Florida brunch on Sunday morning. 350 people came to support school choice and vouchers and a whole slew of programs that are giving our schools millions and millions of dollars. Really extraordinary. The work of Daniel Adler, a member of our show. So afterwards, I thought it was amazing, and it's doing real great work for our community. But afterwards, someone whose parents are Holocaust survivors, but told me, he said, you know, why do we have to stir the pot? Right? Let's just live in America, we'll sit off to the side. What do we have to become so politically engaged and involved for? And we're going to fight for all these things in our schools. And all of a sudden, the public schools and those who send to public schools are going to be resentful of all the Jews. Right? What do we got to stir the pot for? It's going to breed anti-Semitism. Let's just live peacefully in America. Right? The other argument is, no, we Jews, we pay a lot of taxes. We should receive the benefits that other people are receiving. We have influence financially, politically. Why don't we wield that influence to accomplish our goals, right? So these aren't just situations that challenged our people in World War II. They continue to this day, obviously in a different context. But how much do you use power? There were those in World War II that felt that if you challenge authority too much, it'll subvert your power. It'll weaken your power. History, we look back at that and say, how could you not have used more power? Right? So again, it's always easy to judge, but you see that these are complicated issues. These aren't so easy all the time. And you would imagine that that was what was going through Nehemiah's mind as he was sitting in Shushan. Now, we know that he's the butler, right? He's the wine pourer. He's the sommelier of Artaxerxes. So he's on the inside. He's a political insider. And he's in the palace every single day. And he's wondering, should I speak up? Should I not speak up? Should I speak up? Should I not speak up? Is this the right day? No, the king's not in the perfect mood. Let me wait till tomorrow. Because if I catch him at the wrong... Now, who else does this? Esther. Right? Esther. Now, we're going to see that there are a lot... I'm not playing on my phone. I seem to have gotten cold in here very quickly. I will adjust that equally quickly. Right, Esther. And we'll see that there are going to be a lot of similarities between this story and Esther. Okay? So let's keep that in the back of your mind. So here we go. Let me just put this back on. Okay, so here we go. So he's nervous. He's anxious. He doesn't know. Should I be wielding power? Should I not be wielding power? Is it a good thing? Is it not a good thing? And he's waiting for the perfect moment. Because again, if he catches the king at the wrong time, this wasn't, you get a demerit. You have to go to detention. This was like an off-with-your-head society. Think to the story of Ahasuerus. Right? Think to the story of Ahasuerus. What happens when Vashti crosses the king? Off with her head. Okay, we know that that was the society that we were living in. Ahasuerus had already happened. So you don't envision that a lot had changed between the story of Esther and this story, which happens after. So Nehemiah is petrified. He doesn't know when's the right time, when's not the right time. All of a sudden, he comes to work one day, 5 months after finding out about how bad things are in Israel, and the king says, right, v'lo ha'isi ra lefanav. What does that mean, v'lo ha'isi ra lefanav? It means that he was always in a good mood, the Meforshim point out. He was always jovial, right? The king wanted to surround himself with high energy, positive people, and Nehemiah is that positive guy. Hey, Mr. King, what's going on? Great day. You see the weather? Beautiful, right? No one wants a winemaker that's like, oh, Mr. King, I have a great bottle of Pinot Noir from 533. It was a great vintage year of the year. No one wants that, right? So the king surrounded himself with happy people. And Nehemiah was a happy person. Vayomer li amelech, but Pasuk 2, the king says to him, Madua panecha ra'im. Why are you so sad today? Why do you have that look on your face today? Ve'ata incha chole. Yeah, take his temperature. 98.6, he's not sick. Ein zek imroa leiv. What does the king assume? that he's going to rebel. He's going to poison his drink. Right? Think about it. You know, you go on an Al Al flight. So I'm not hiding anything. I'm bringing like a change of t-shirt when I go to Israel for a week. Right? And yet, when you show up at Al Al security, and they're like, what parsha is it this week? And you're like, oh no, I don't remember, right? So, and they're obviously waiting to see how you answer. Do you sweat? Do you make eye contact? Your hands, right? They're trained to detect these certain things. So all of a sudden, Nehemiah comes into the palace, and he's usually in such a good mood, and the king sees that he's shaking a little bit today, he's not in a good mood, and the king assumes that he's about to do something naughty, that he's about to do something bad. Now, if you're the wine pourer, if you're the sommelier, you could easily poison the king's wine. Think back to the story of Sarah Mashkim and the story of Yosef in Paro, right? So the king says, Ki'im roa lev, I assume that you have nefarious intentions right now. Ve'ira harbe ma'od. And Nehemiah hears this, and what does he do? He starts shaking. Right, again, we can't even fathom what it was like to be before a king like that, an all-powerful king, who with a flick of a wrist you'd be off with your head. And all of a sudden the king questions your loyalty and thinks that you're about to poison him, you'd be shaking in your boots also. Okay? You'd be shaking in your boots. Va'omar lamelech, hamelech, Le'olam yichyeh, long live the king. Okay, madua lo yira'u panai asher ha'ir beit kvarot avotai chareva usharea uchlu ba'ish. You would also be in a bad mood if your place of birth, your ancestral homeland, was a disaster and was a disgrace and was destroyed. What do you want? Right? There's always, my first rabbinic mentor taught me that whenever someone comes to meet with you, figure out quickly why they're coming to meet with you. Right? What do you want? What's the purpose of this? Va'et palel el Elohei Hashamay. To me, those are four amazing words. Right? Now, obviously, he's sitting before the king. King questions his loyalty. He blurts out, no, you would also be in a bad mood if your homeland was destroyed. King says back to him, what do you want? Now he's not davening to Hashem. Ashrei Yisrael, Ori Alucha, right? No, he's not doing that in the middle in front of the king. What does it mean, Vatpalel Hashem? It means, in his heart, he pauses for a second and he says, Hashem, give me the wisdom to say the right thing right now. What an amazing thing. It means that tefillah, prayer, isn't always from a sitter. Right? You can, if you're hard, you're about to have a difficult meeting, you're about to go into a difficult appointment, you're about to dive into Hashem from your heart for a second. Right? It's an amazing, amazing four words. Va'omar la'melech, im alamelech tov, v'im yitav avdecha lefanecha. If it please us, you guys even caught up on that, right? Imal HaMelech Tov. We know that from the story of Esther. Exact same phraseology. I can sit down. You go here. You can give the clue, right? No, that's exactly right. V'imitav avdecha lefanecha. And if I find favor in your eyes, Asher tishalcheni el Yehuda el ir kivrot avotai ve'evnena. Right? Can you give me a leave of absence? I want to take off a little bit from work. Send me to Yehuda. Allow me to rebuild my homeland. Vayomer li amelech v'hashegal yoshevet etzlo. So the queen sitting next to him. And he says to the king and to the queen. I'm sorry, the king and queen says to him, Ad matai yeh mehalechecha umatai tashu. Right, how long do you want off from work for? Vayitav lefnei hamelech v'yishalcheni v'etna lo zman. It doesn't tell exactly, but I gave him a time. Worked for the king, he penciled me in on as vacation days, and I went. Va'omar la'melech, ima la'melech tov, igrot yitnuli al pechavot everanar Asher Yaviruni Ad Asher Avo El Yehuda. Right? Can you write me a note, a get out of jail free note that's going to give me permission for when I go? And that's exactly what the king does. He writes him a note, and then next week we're going to learn about his actual journey. Now, what's significant here? Oh, wait, one more pasuk. Pasuk 9 is important also. Vavo al pachavot ever anar ve'nem lahem et igeret ha-melech. He gives them the get out of jail free card. Vayishlach imi ha-melech sarechayel uprashim. What does the king send with him?
Security.
An army to escort him. Protective security force. Now, we just learned a lot, whether you realize it or not. Okay? First, let's compare Nehemiah with Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah start off the same way. What do they both do? They daven. Almost verbatim, exactly the same thing. They fast, they daven, they sit down on the ground, they lament. What was the result of Ezra's davening? People gathered around him, but who's the actor in Sefer Ezra? The people. In fact, we felt Ezra was a little bit passive in his approach. He sat, he modeled by example, but it was always other people that initiated. Right? Oh, Ezra, shouldn't we do this? Oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Who's the initiator here? Nehemiah. Right? Nehemiah immediately upon... Well, not immediately, but let's say immediately, springs into action. And he's the one who approaches the king, and he's the one who asks for permission, and he clearly has a plan in his mind of what he wants to accomplish. So that in and of itself is a critically important contrast, which we'll see is going to continue throughout. Nehemiah is clearly politically astute. He plays the king perfectly. Now, we don't know how the situation went down. In other words, is it that Nehemiah just happened to find himself in the right time, in the right place? He was stewing over this for 5 months. All of a sudden, the king questions his loyalty. He sees it as an opening, and he goes for the kill, so to speak, and he goes for the ask. Or is Nehemiah plotting this the whole time? Nehemiah is waiting for that opening. He's just waiting for the time where the king will... Does he show up that day, looking a little sad on purpose, so that the king will question it? We don't know. And by the way, different Mephorshim read it a little bit differently. But either way, you have the sense that as opposed to Ezra, where he's described as a sofer, where when I asked you, what does a sofer conjure, what image in your mind, what was sitting down, humble, like this, big beard? Nehemiah, how would you describe him? If you had to paint a picture of him right now. Well, he's not sitting hunched over a Gemara. Where is he? He's in the king palace. So you picture him in a tuxedo, right? Clean shaven, slicked back hair maybe. And he plays the king perfectly, because once the king gives him the opening, he gets exactly what he wants. He's ready. He's ready for the ask. Okay, so Nehemiah is clearly much more politically astute than Ezra is at this point in time. Now, as you guys jumped upon immediately, there are significant references to the story of Esther. Now, Esther happens, I forgot my exact dates, but I believe it's about 40 years prior to this, historically. So, Nehemiah knows about Esther. She is his political anchor, beacon of light, that he's going to reference for how he's going to approach the situation. He's going to look at Esther's playbook and take pages out of her playbook. So where do we start? Number one, both Esther and Nehemiah are in positions of influence. Okay, they're in the palace. Number two, they both are nervous to approach the king. Esther, we know, is very nervous until Mordechai gives her the kick in the pants and she has to go, the kick in the skirt, and she has to go. Right? Nehemiah is also very nervous. Number three, both wait before approaching the king. In Esther's case, it's 3 days. In Nehemiah's case, it's 5 months, but there's that ambivalence, there's that nervousness, there's that waiting. Okay? Both instances, you have the king's wife, okay, playing a role in how it plays out. In both, when they make their request, what is the What is the foundation of their request? Remember Esther's exact verbiage? Molarati, right? No, she's referencing her heritage and her ancestry. That's exactly what Nehemiah does here. He, again, takes the page right out of Esther's playbook. There's one additional component, which I think is striking. And that is, while we know it's Artaxashta, because the Pasuk tells us, how is he referred to? 15 times throughout the first 9 psukim of chapter 2. Hamelech. Now we know that word Hamelech from the story of the Megillah. Because how is Achashverosh referred to countless times? Hamelech, as you guys already jumped when it says, Ima Melech Tov, if it's in... Now who's the Melech in the Purim story? So we know the famous comment, it's not just the Melech Achashverosh, but there's that parallel narrative is the story of Hashem. It's a reference to Hashem. And one wonders here, when you look in Pasuk, where am I? When you look in Pasuk Zion, Pasuk 7, and he says, Va'omar la'melech, imala melech tov. Right? If it's good with the king, Pasuk Hey, sorry. Imala melech tov, imitav avdecha lefanecha. If it's good in your eyes, and send me back. Is that kind of... Because don't forget, how did Pasuk Gimel end? I'm sorry, how did Pasuk Dalet end? With him davening to Hashem. Pasuk Hey has him talking to the melech. And he says, if it befits the melech, do good by me. Allow me to be successful. Well, who is that melech there? Is Pasuk Hey the continuation of his tefillah to Hashem? Is Pasuk Hey his conversation with Artaxashta? Well, we don't know, and that's the point. Same way we don't always know in the story of Esther who's the king and who's the king, we don't really know here in Pasuk Dalet and Hey who's the king and who's the king. In it's the same point in each. In the book of Esther, why does the Navi, why does the Ksuvim do that? It's to remind us that while you think the Melech is in charge, really the Melech is in charge. And that's exactly the impression that you gain right here by learning Pasuk Dalet and Hey. Is the Melech in charge? Is this really about Artaxashta? Or is this about the Melech Malchei Amlachim? Is this about HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And so you have an enormous amount of parallels between the two of them. To me, the most important one is that both risk their lives to accomplish their feat. Right? When Esther approaches Achashverosh, she does that with an enormous amount of personal risk. That's why she doesn't want to do it. Until Mordechai says, I don't care if you die doing this. You're in a position of power. You have to do it. Get over it. It's not about you. It's about the people. Same thing here. When Nehemiah approaches the king, he does it with an enormous amount of personal sacrifice. If he's wrong, if he times it wrong, king's going to kill him. If he times it right, he'll get what he wants. But that's an enormous risk that he's taking. And so perhaps most importantly, the commonality between the two of them is a story of the people in a precarious situation who require a leader that's willing to undergo personal sacrifice for the betterment of the people. And it's only when leaders are willing to step forward with that sense of sacrifice in both stories, that's the turning point of the story. It's only when Esther comes forward and is willing to sacrifice her life for her people that she's successful. And Nehemiah here, right? Everything that emerges is going to be from these psukim of Nehemiah willing to undergo that sacrifice in order to approach the king. And so we've been introduced to Nehemiah. We've been given little teasers into who Nehemiah is. Is he a political force? Is he a religious force? I don't know. He has a little bit of each. He's in the king's palace, but he's quoting psukim, and he's davening to Hashem. So we're given a lot of the foundation to build upon. And as we continue learning about Nehemiah, and again, until Ezra comes back, it's the next six chapters of Nehemiah is going to be a lot about Nehemiah and his efforts. You're going to see this profile continue to build itself layer upon layer to help us understand exactly who he was, what he was trying to accomplish, and ultimately how he contrasts with Ezra. Everyone have a great week. Yeah, sorry.